From KALW News in San Francisco, this is a special edition of Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Redwood City.
Belmont.
Midtown. San Jose.
19th Avenue. San Francisco.
San Mateo.
Sunnyvale. Coming up, we mark the anniversary of the Occupy movement.
We shall overcome the...
We'll consider what Occupy looks like today and the new spaces people are occupying, from people's homes.
He could not believe that we came to his house. You know, I'm like, you're dealing with the Occupy, but you know, we can't get you at work. We're coming to your house.
To museum walls.
It's a pretty amazing thing that, you know, these posters are not done working. These posters are still working. These are working posters.
And this is a working radio program working to earn your support on an hour-long edition of Cross Currents. Welcome back to Cross Currents from KALW News, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area. I'm Holly Kernan.
And I'm Ben Trefney.
As you just heard, demonstrators are gathering at the former Bank of America building in downtown San Francisco. They're doing it in cities around the country, marking the anniversary of the Occupy movement. Today on the show, we want to reflect on the sights and sounds of Occupy from the past year. And to get us started, Holly, why don't you tell us where you are right now?
Well, I'm at Frank Ogawa Plaza in downtown Oakland in front of City Hall, and I figured this would be a good place to start our show today since it's where one of the Bay Area's most visible Occupy encampments was set up just under a year ago. As everybody will remember, last September, activists in New York set up camp in Zuccotti Park to protest what they saw as big banks' predatory policies. And then we all watched as in a matter of weeks, the Occupy movement quickly spread to cities all over the world, including here in Oakland.
That's right. Oakland became a big center, and activists renamed the plaza the Oscar Grant Plaza. And this is what the tent city sounded like then.
Mic check.
Mic check.
My name is Richard.
My name is Richard.
We have a supply tent where we have clothes that are donated and blankets and sleeping bags.
Hi, my name is Jonathan. I'm a project manager, and I am one of the 99%. I have three words for you. Move your money.
We have a school where we have information. We media tent. We have an info tent. We even have a little garden growing. And we have a full kitchen. No one's hungry.
This society is not serving the needs of so many people. And that's what we have in common in lots and lots and lots of different ways.
There's no one individual that could take responsibility for anything that is done here. Everything is a collective effort.
I just want to be a part of, you know what I'm saying? This is very important right here. This is history. This is going on all around the world.
Police officers raided the camp several times, setting off a series of high-profile confrontations between activists and police.
Helicopter bastard! ACIB!
But the movement continued. There was a general strike, the shutdown of the Port of Oakland. It was a very tense time there.
Yeah, and the effects are still being felt today.
So, Holly, what does the plaza look or sound like right now?
Well, it sounds like this. So it's actually pretty quiet. There's a few people walking around, and a leaf blower is in the background there. And the plaza is completely fenced off right now. The city is keeping people away so that it can replant the grass.
Christine Schaff from the Department of Public Works says, quote, "The lawn was destroyed after Occupy last year," end quote. And the replanting had to be done before the winter. There haven't been tents there since December or so, and that's about when all encampments around the country started winding down.
But while the physical occupations may have been short-lived, the Occupy movement has remained a continuous presence in Bay Area activism. Large-scale events like the November general strike and march in Oakland have given way to smaller offshoots focused on specific issues. In March, students protested as Occupy Education, naming March 1st a National Day of Action.
And in April, protesters calling themselves Occupy the Farm took over a UC Berkeley-owned piece of land over in Albany. They wanted to stop development, and they wanted to turn it into a community urban agriculture site.
Whose farm?
Our farm!
Whose farm?
Our farm!
Whose farm?
Our
Then this past summer, Occupy Oakland provided logistical support to parents over at Lakeview Elementary School, where they staged a sit-in to protest the school's closure.
In these past few weeks before the anniversary, this plaza has been empty, but actions leading up to today have been taking place all over the Bay Area. And in fact, Occupy Oakland is actually protesting in San Francisco today. And in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park, activists staged a human bee-in.
Right, it's called a bee-in. It's a take on human being and the traditional sit-in, so you got a bee-in. It was something that really started up in the late 1960s. And today, in Berkeley, Rabbi Michael Lerner has planned a protest. He and other Jewish leaders wanted to mark Rosh Hashanah by protesting exploitive practices that have caused the financial crisis.
We're calling it Occupy Rosh Hashanah because the laws of justice that are in the Torah that say that loans should be forgiven every 7 years, the time to do this is Rosh Hashanah, at the beginning of the new year. So it's totally appropriate that on Rosh Hashanah, we should be going to the banks to say, okay, we're not expecting you to loan without interest. We're not expecting you to forgive all loans. But at the very least, in the spirit of what that Bible is about, you should be fair in the way that you treat people.
Also, organizers are occupying banks today in solidarity with foreclosure fighters all around the Bay. In San Francisco, Occupy Bernal gathered at the War Memorial to protest foreclosures that veterans are facing.
Brother Robert Moses, 92 years of age, World War II Navy vet.
I filed for modification for 3 times, and at my age, they saved my pension and my retirement is not enough to get the modification.
We shall overcome the bank.
And as we heard earlier, demonstrators, including members of Occupy Oakland, are gathering in front of the former Bank of America building right now. So as you can hear, Occupy may not be as big as it was last fall, but the movement is still around, if you know where to look for it. Hey, Holly, why don't you head back to the studio while we hear KALW's Jen Sheehan bring us a closer look at the group that we just heard from, Occupy Bernal.
Okay, I'll see you soon. I'm on my way back to San Francisco. Jen, take it away.
Come out and talk to us. Don't throw us under the bus.
On a September Sunday afternoon, 24 San Francisco homeowners and activists are gathered in front of venture capitalist Peter Brigger's house in the wealthy South Bay suburb of Atherton. They're staging a protest. Brigger is co-chairman of Fortress Investment Group, which owns the company foreclosing on some of the demonstrators' homes. The demonstrators are surprised when Brigger actually steps out of his house to meet them. He listens to some of the homeowners speak and then agrees to look into their cases.
I will make sure that the 7 situations here, or there are 8, get looked into specifically by the senior management of NationStar and that they come back to you.
Can you do that before Wednesday for the 2 that have evictions on Wednesday?
The group presses Brigger to do more. They want him to stop the impending evictions of 2 of the homeowners. Brigger tells them he can't make that promise. But the next day, the evictions are postponed.
He could not believe that we came to his house. You know, I'm like, you're dealing with the Occupy, but you know, we can't get you at work. We're coming to your house.
Ross Rhodes is a member of Occupy Bernal, a local offshoot of the Greater Occupy movement based in San Francisco's Bernal Heights neighborhood. He's lived in Bernal since the 60s, and was facing foreclosure on his own home when he got involved with the group back in February. Occupy actually came to his house, too.
On that Wednesday night around 9 o'clock, a guy pulled up to my driveway, and he had a big brown dog in the car. It was raining outside. His door was open, and he was ringing my bell. And I'm looking out of the window, and I'm like, who is this? This ain't the bank. They're coming 9 o'clock at night?
It wasn't the bank. It was a member of Occupy Bernal named Buck Baggett. He had heard about Rhodes' situation and had come to ask him to join the group. Baggett is also a longtime resident of Bernal Heights and a self-described leftist activist since the early 70s. He and a handful of other activism-inclined neighbors founded Occupy Bernal in early January, coming together around another neighbor's impending foreclosure.
I got a call from Beth Richards and Annie Sprinkle, whose neighbor, Thomas German, was in foreclosure. And I didn't, fool that I am, I didn't realize that foreclosure was such a big problem in Bernal Heights. So they said, will you come over and help us figure it out? I said, sure.
Baggett says at that point, most members of the group were not facing foreclosure themselves, but wanted to take action to help those who were.
Frankly, I didn't know bupkis about foreclosure, and none of the rest of us did.
But once they started to look into it, they found the problem was much more widespread than they would have thought. According to real estate website Block Shopper, foreclosures were almost unheard of in Bernal until 2010, when the rate jumped from 0 per year to 17, and it's kept climbing since. As of last week, 83 Bernal homes were in foreclosure. Though home prices have climbed significantly in the last two decades, the neighborhood has historically been working class. Many of the homeowners in trouble are longtime residents. Some had paid off their mortgages years before, but became targets of predatory lending during the housing bubble. Many are low-income, people of color, or seniors. Baggett says that initially, Occupy Bernal didn't totally reflect that.
We were pretty much white ex-New-Left radicals when we started.
The group has diversified over time, as more people signed on to fight neighborhood foreclosures.
So the only way we were going to learn about it was by working with some of our neighbors in helping them fight their particular situation.
Neighbors like Ross Rhodes. He eventually won his fight to get a loan modification, but has stuck around and become a leader in the group. Around 40 or 50 people now show up to weekly action planning meetings. Many are homeowners who have faced or are facing foreclosure. Mary Jo Musney and her husband won a loan modification on their home through their affiliation with Occupy Bernal.
I feel that, and my husband feels as well, and we know that we owe a debt of gratitude to the people who helped us, and we're paying it forward. We're out there as often as we can.
Outreach updates from Deborah and Susan or whoever else might have outreach updates that they want to share.
Meetings take place every week in Bernal Heights, as well as at the San Francisco offices of the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, or ACE. ACE is a nonprofit that had already been advocating for homeowners facing foreclosure and eviction. The members of Occupy Bernal allied with them from the beginning. Together, they help homeowners understand their paperwork, advocate for them with the banks, and plan press conferences and demonstrations like the one at Peter Brigger's house. They've also been successful at stopping evictions and property auctions by bringing large groups of people to disrupt the proceedings. Buck Baggett says the combination of Occupy and ACE is a winning one.
Since we started working in January, nobody's had a property auction. I find it kind of hard to believe myself, but it's true.
Taking the time to talk to people and make personal connections has led to a continuous growth of the organization. For example, there's now an Occupy Noe Valley. And many people who wouldn't have thought to align themselves with the Occupy movement have been drawn in, either through neighborhood door-knocking campaigns or old-fashioned word of mouth. Larry Falks is facing foreclosure on his Diamond Heights home. He says he was initially wary about coming to a meeting with these Occupy people.
My fear when I came to the first meeting, my vision of it was be a group of people with tambourines and bullhorns, and that's what's going to save the world. And I thought, no.
But when he went to the meeting, he says he found something different.
I was surprised to see that there was a lot of older people like me. The group has lots of people of color like me. And the diversity made me feel more comfortable.
Activist Buck Baggett says Occupy Bernal was meant
to try and take the possibilities created by Occupy and the ideals stated by Occupy and root them in a struggle in our neighborhood, a concrete struggle in our neighborhood.
Ross Rhodes says that kind of change is exactly why he continues to align himself with the Occupy movement. He says he doesn't know what the future of Occupy is, but he believes it's changed the political discourse in America, just like it changed his own thinking.
It's the haves and the have-nots. You know, that's what it was in my eyes. It's the half and the have-nots, but we put a number on it, the 1% and the 99%. And yeah, that opened my mind to the perspective of life or how we're living today.
The weekly foreclosure fighters meeting ends with the whole group standing up to sing a traditional protest song. Though the lyrics may be from another time, they have special resonance for the people in the room today. In San Francisco, I'm Jen Chien for Cross Currents.
Thank you to KALW's RJ Sloan, Laura Flynn, and Artyom Skonohovs for contributing sound for that report. You can hear all of our Occupy coverage over the past year at kalw.org, and that's also where you can become a member of KALW and support reports like the one you just heard. Just click that big button. It says, Donate Now. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, and now with me back in the studio is our usual host and news director, Holly Kernan. Welcome back.
Thank you. All right, coming up, we follow the movement as it occupies a new space, the walls of an art museum.
We feel like the movement itself is quite sprawling, and there's many different points of view that are represented in the Occupy movement as a whole, and we wanted to kind of respond to that by not being too rigid in the organization of it.
You're listening to a special hour-long edition of Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan.
And I'm Ben Trefney. And as we look back on Occupy today, we've been sharing some of the most characteristic sounds of the movement. Many were slogans like these. The images of Occupy were just as iconic. Tent cities and urban plazas, faces covered with bandanas, and a sea of protesters carrying political posters.
Well, guess where those posters are now, Ben? They're hanging in an art museum. Seriously, they're at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts for an exhibit called Occupy Bay Area. The exhibit both showcases the local art that was inspired by Occupy and connects this movement to other social and political protests of the past.
But does that inadvertently put Occupy in the past tense? KALW's Taja Lanier talked to some of the artists and the curator to find out.
Artist John Paul Bale was at a coffee shop in the East Bay when his friend walked in and said,
Hey, we're going to go down to Oscar Grant Plaza and kick it in a tent and spend the night. And I was like, really? You're going to go down there and do that? It's going to rain tonight. And they're like, come on, JP, dude, you can't choose when things go down because you don't like the weather. And I was like, I really don't want to go down there and spend the night in this weather.
But a few days later, Bale showed up at the Occupy encampment with some of his artwork.
Gave out, 45 posters instantly, and then within 2 days, we were printing on site. So that was really my moment, was when I'm printing, and I look behind me, and there's 450 people standing behind me, and we're printing these posters.
And just like that, Bale became an Occupy activist. He was one of many artists who were putting images behind demands for economic equality and increased transparency in the financial system. One of the Occupy posters inspired artist Chuck Sperry to get involved.
Someone sent me a picture of the Adbusters poster with the ballerina poised on one foot on top of the bowl. And it said, Occupy Wall Street, September 17th, 2011, bring a tent. And I thought, this is cool. Whatever's going on is, a little different.
Sperry is the man behind the poster that declared, This is our city and we can shut it down. It's composed of bright colors and big block letters, reminiscent of the rock posters he makes for a living. On November 2nd, 2011, his artwork spoke to protesters who shut down the Port of Oakland.
Mic check! A lot of people didn't hear, but the port has called off work for the 7 p.m. shift.
When I'm making a political poster, I'm drawing upon this history that starts with the freedom of speech movement onto the psychedelic movement, the rock poster, and I'm bringing all this knowledge to bear on just making a simple statement. One of the reasons I wanted to use these sort of psychedelic colors is it had a positive, sort of warm, inviting feel to it. It wasn't this kind of dark, grainy, black and white political poster that you're so used to seeing that you almost kind of turn off to it. This is something that someone might put in their kitchen, and it might be a bit nourishing. And if you were to see a sea of these walking down the street, you would go, these people are positive.
John Paul Bale's poster is very Northern California. Hella Occupy is printed across the top. The poster is drawn almost like a political cartoon, with images depicting a city in chaos.
We knew that shit was going to hit the fan downtown, so we totally illustrated what was going to take place. And so, you know, when we were going through the idea of the poster, I just randomly was thinking, you know, the system sucks, we are the 99%, and this poster is black and red. Red is to represent Marxism and black for anarchy.
Communism and anarchy are just two of many buzzwords that became associated with Occupy as it unfolded last fall. Today, the movement isn't as visible in the streets, but activists are still involved in issues such as fighting foreclosures and keeping schools open. The movement has also entered the art world through a recent exhibit at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. It's called Occupy Bay Area. The exhibit features photo prints, posters, audio, and even video installations that blanket the walls of a big room and surrounding hallways. Betty Sue Hertz is the curator of the exhibit, and she says she intentionally designs the space this way.
We feel like the movement itself is quite sprawling, and there's many different points of view that are represented in the Occupy movement as a whole, and we wanted to kind of respond to that by not being too rigid in the organization of it.
That approach gives off a pretty confusing image. You may as well be in a teenager's bedroom during his punk phase. But you'll notice that Hertz took care to provide historical context and to connect the artwork to posters from previous movements.
So we really think of the encampment as being something very special about Occupy. It's what defines Occupy in many ways. And we then look back to strikes, to sit-ins, to other kinds of encampments. And the power of being able to take over a public space as a site from which you make your statements.
I asked Hertz if it's too soon to tell what the long-lasting effects of the movement will be. She says it's never too early to consider those questions. Rather, she sees the exhibit as part of keeping the movement alive, not marking its decline.
We are in the position to respond very quickly and to hopefully be able to be a platform for continuing the dialogues that were happening on the streets and to bring those dialogues to a broader audience, because not everyone was going to the encampment, not everyone was participating in the Occupy movement. And an exhibition space like this is relatively neutral. Anyone can come. And it is a space where you can really consider and think about these ideas without feeling uncomfortable or that this is not your scene or I don't know why I would go out there at night or whatever it is.
The exhibit attracted Jim Dunwoody from Petaluma. He was never involved in the movement, but considers himself a supporter. When asked about the vitality of the Occupy movement, he said,
I guess it just kind of petered out. I don't know. I think so. It wore itself out, maybe. Who knows?
Exhibit visitor Christopher Van Putten, who was an Occupy activist in Portland, sees it differently.
The 2012 for Occupy has been more of an emergence and an acceptance and a recognition in the public mindset. The initial efforts of Occupy in 2011 kind of manifested themselves in more activism, and that's transformed over the time as less direct activism yielded any kind of direct results, but more permeated into all the infrastructures, into the dialogues, into the modern conversation of the American people and of the world people, really.
So what I think he means is that Occupy is still active, but in a different way. Artists Chuck Sperry and John Paul Bale would agree. Even though they say it's a bit early for this kind of exhibit, Bale says it's exciting to have the Yerba Buena Center recognize his artwork while it's still on the streets.
Right now, we're still pasting the Hella Occupy Oakland poster up in Oakland, and we're having the buffers come and buff the poster. The word on the street is no political art on the streets of Oakland, period. So all the money that's usually spent cleaning up the bubble graffiti is being spent on wiping out political posters for the first time probably in my lifetime. And so it's real hot right now that, you know, the poster's been institutionalized and is in, currently hanging at the Oakland Museum and hanging now over at the city, and the poster's still at work on the street getting buffed by the system. So it's a pretty amazing thing that, you know, these posters are not done working. These posters are still working. These are working posters.
But in a very different way. Once they were a direct call for action, and now they're hanging in an art center. Even though there is very little happening on the streets today, maybe the simple act of appreciating the art of the movement can help keep the Occupy message alive. For Cross Currents, I'm Taja Lanier.
You can see the Occupy Bay Area exhibit yourself at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts until October 14th. This is an hour-long edition of Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan.
And I'm Ben Trefney. Coming up, what it takes to land an apartment in San Francisco's rental market.
How many people asked to pay over what you were asking?
Eight people. Eight people asked, and I said no. Also, two, in addition to two people, they asked to prepay it for a year, and I said no.
This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan.
And I'm Ben Trefney. We've been talking about the Occupy movement today, and earlier we met a group of occupiers who are still active in San Francisco's Bernal Heights. That group is focusing on the foreclosures in that neighborhood, which is a sign of how the housing crisis is far from over.
If you want another sign, just look at the rental market. Our city by the bay has the highest rent in the country, and the competition out there for an apartment is fierce. Rents in the city have gone up more than 15% from a year ago. For comparison, rents in other parts of the country are rising with the rate of inflation of about 2.7%.
While some argue that owners are taking advantage of the tech bubble to hike up the market value of their properties, KLW's Lila Day met one owner who says she'll resist the urge to cash in on the rental wars. Lila went to meet her on the day her resolve to play fair would be most tested, the day of her open house.
Okay. It's not a studio and it's not a one-bedroom. We have a separate kitchen. It's been upgraded, new appliances.
Darlene Carpetillo owns this building in San Francisco's Noe Valley. She's just had a tenant move out. That means she can offer the apartment at market price, which works out in her favor. You see, of the 16 units, all but three are rent-controlled, with tenants paying between $400 and $700 per month. But this apartment is going for
$1,300 a month. It is reasonable because we prefer our tenants to stay.
Darlene's preparing for an open house. She's confident that in about an hour, she'll get at least 50 applicants.
Today what's going to happen is it's going to be utter mayhem with applications, credit reports and so forth, and I will definitely get back to everybody, and I will definitely get it rented by today. Are you here to see the apartment? All right, come on up. It's on the first floor.
The open house has officially begun, and a crowd of people are gathered at the front door. Many are dressed as they would before a job interview. Women wearing colorful skirts and pumps, the men wearing clean t-shirts and tennis shoes instead of flip-flops. Most seem to be under 30. I asked several of them to give me a sense of what it takes to succeed in today's rental market.
If you know you want something, you have to just be prepared.
I would like to think I have the edge there because I make some real money, but doesn't seem to be the case.
Things will be up on Craigslist for a day, open houses the next day, and then the decision will have been made the next day after.
And it's painful because it's almost like applying for a job because you tell them about yourself, you tell them how you're a good fit, and it's a pretty painful process.
Pay stubs, credit report and just my application and a good attitude.
I'm totally prepared. Credit report, copy of my driver's license, application, pay stubs.
I guess I wasn't prepared. I didn't realize that there would be so many people with all the, you know, application completed. I mean, I do have, you know, full-time job, stable income, but it seems like a lot of people are, you know, like, oh, I work at Stanford, or like, you know.
I work at Stanford University, which is a little bit of a commute, but I want to live up in the city really bad.
What's going to set you apart? Will she remember me? How do they make their decision? I don't know. You want to make it as easy for the landlord as possible. Like, I noticed somebody mentioned that they brought their pay stubs. I was like, oh, that's a great idea. You know, proof that you're legit, basically.
One by one, applicants file into the tiny apartment unit, cramming into the bathroom to inspect the drawers, eyeing the closet space and pointing out how they would arrange their furniture. I squeeze into the kitchen with the building owner, Darlene. A line has formed in front of her that wraps along the wall, out the kitchen door, and down the hallway to the front door of the apartment. Applicants wait for a chance to shake her hand, to make some sort of impression, or even to offer more money.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
I do. Would you take higher than what you offer?
Pardon me?
Would you take a higher bid?
No, sorry, that's not there.
How many people asked to pay over what you were asking?
Eight people asked, and I said no. Also, in addition to two people, they asked to prepay it for a year, and I said no.
And you said it in front of everyone, and they ask in front of everyone.
Exactly, so I figure if they can ask, I can turn around and say no.
We have a coin-operated washer and dryer in the garage.
Can
we keep with us? No parking, it's just street parking.
Right.
The line in the kitchen is moving fast. Darlene is shaking hands and moving them out the door with a mechanical smile.
Okay, so I'll fill this out and then I'll leave you with the application and my credit report.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
They pull out their resumes and fire off their credentials.
I'm in online advertising. I work for LinkedIn, which is in Mountain View. But they have an office here in San Francisco, so I'll be splitting my time between both offices.
I'm going to be working in for PayPal, so tech, I guess. And I'm looking to move to the city because the commute would be easier. I presently live in the East Bay.
In the stairwell, a young applicant sits with her mother. She nervously goes back into the apartment to add something to her application. Her brother has just arrived. He's come as backup and hopes that he can put in a few good words about his sister.
I think that's the owner over there. Yeah, if I could talk to her and see if there's anything I could tell her to let my sister rent this place because, you know, I'm concerned for her safety and her well-being and, you know, I'm just doing whatever I can to help her. Yeah, she's got moms here. I don't know if you talked to mom too, but essentially she's got the whole family here with the exception of my brother and my dad, but...
Okay, Gloria, thank you. Thank you, Gloria.
And just like that, the flurry of anxiety, eagerness, and awkwardness of the open house is over. The apartment once again has a vacant echo, and the lights are turned off, cabinets closed. At $1,300, most of the applicants left thinking this was a great deal. The city doesn't regulate how much a property owner can charge, just how much they can raise the rent each year once a lease is signed. So market value is really up to comparing the Craigslist postings. As for Darlene, she says the open house was a lot like speed dating. These 50 people will all be anxiously awaiting for her call. But minutes after the open house is over, she's pretty sure she's found her match.
Now her mom came to see it. Her brother came to see it. Her sister-in-law came to see it. And she's here because they're concerned about her. Now if you're family-orientated, you'll say, hey, I think that's cool.
Darlene decides to offer it to the young lady who brought her family. Like dating, it boils down to a gut feeling, and this landlord said she was sold by the whole package. Her steady job, family values, and her ability to pick up the bill. In San Francisco, I'm Leela Day for Cross Currents.
Coming up, we asked you who the most passionate people in the Bay Area are, and you responded.
It's an incredible thing to see someone that is so dedicated to the well-being of families and to the well-being of the educational system of the public schools in San Francisco.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan.
And I'm Ben Trefney.
In the past few weeks, we've asked you to tell us about the most passionate people you know in the Bay Area so that we can share their stories with our listeners. Here's a nomination we got from Ellen Schatz.
I wanted to just nominate Todd David. He is somebody in Noe Valley, and he created a nonprofit called EdMatch because he noticed that there was a huge discrepancy between all the public schools in the San Francisco Unified School District between the fundraising that their PTA does. And so he wanted to find a way both to get local businesses and corporations involved to have a little bit of more civic collaboration and at the same time balance out some of the inequities and figure a way to disperse some funds on a per capita basis per student through all the public schools.
KALW's Nina Nicole Morente met with Todd David as his family drove him to a meeting. She has this profile.
You know, I have a great supporter, my wife, Tiffany. She drives me to a meeting on the way to driving Isaac to elementary school so that I can go meet with a member of the business community and see if we can, you know, convince him that this is a good program to support.
The kids are actually really funny about it, too. They're like, Daddy is always at a meeting, on the phone, or on his computer. So that's what it's like. I mean, it's wonderful. He's so committed in what he's doing, and he's really effective, and he's making fabulous things happen.
Rodrigo Santos, who is actually running for, he was actually just appointed community college board. Rodrigo and I have been talking, you know, for months about, you know, him being involved in EdMatch and also him kind of helping be the bridge to the business community. So, Rodrigo, you know, I just wanted to follow up on some conversations that we've been having, you know, for a while now. It's one of the things that I feel like I preach all the time, but, you know, like most people, right, I'm preaching to the choir, right?
So, no, but you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. There is a pragmatic linkage to this. An educated workforce is precisely what the business sector wants. It's an incredible thing to see someone that is so dedicated to the well-being of families and to the well-being of the educational system of the public schools in San Francisco.
What do you love about your work? What do you love most about it?
I truly believe that EdMatch's vision and its mission is to, you know, further the academic outcomes of every child in the city. And, you know, should public education be well funded by the public sector, by the state? Absolutely. I believe it. Is it being funded? Is it being well funded by the state? No, it's not. You know, I also believe the state has abdicated its responsibility. Believing that and, you know, and seeing that, how can one not work hard? I mean, it's natural. It goes hand in hand. Every day I wake up and I feel like, you know, we can make a difference today.